Welcome, guys. I'm delighted to have Alex Craner with me. He is a hedge fund manager and also a qualified, bona fide author on the commodities markets. In fact, one of his best books, help me with the title, Managing Uncertainty in the Commodities Market. Is that correct, Alex?
Mastering Uncertainty.
Mastering, even better. Mastering Uncertainty. I knew I'd let that one word slip. After won an award, and not only that, began to sell exceedingly well. And as a bit of a backstory, he hadn't received checks from Amazon for the better part of 3 years, Alex, and has largely then subsequently got cancelled, and then started to have this runaway success for this particular title. Anyway, welcome, Alex, and take off with that narrative as well, if you will.
Thank you.
Tell everybody what happened.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me, Francis. It's an honor to be on your podcast. I should say at last, because this is my first time on your podcast.
We're glad to have you.
Yeah, basically what happened is I published two trading titles. So one of them is called Mastering Uncertainty in Commodities Trading, and the other one is called Alex Craner's Trend Following Bible. And the first title, which was published in 2015, it got an award by a site called financialexpert.co.uk, gave it number one book, number one in the top five books for on commodities for investors and traders for 2021 and 2022. And at that point, the book started selling really well. And that's when I noticed that I wasn't receiving any checks from Amazon for Amazon for royalties. And even though Amazon, you know, was showing my royalties balance going down every month as though they were paying me, but they weren't. And then when I asked, like, well, guys, where's this money going? Why am I not receiving anything? Then it took about 3 months of going back and forth, you know. It then made it obvious that they would make it as hard as possible. And then when finally some person emailed me and saying like, oh yeah, right, we actually owe you some money, we'll be wiring you the balance over the next 5 to 8 business days. Then literally 3 hours after that email, I got an email from somebody else at Amazon who said like, oh, by the way, we suspect that you were doing something bad, manipulating on terms of service and whatever. We're canceling your account effective immediately, and we're not gonna pay you out anything. So immediately, my whole account was gone, the book reviews, the everything, and the, you know, royalties accounting database and worksheets. It was all gone. And so, you know, very interesting, because it seems that this is part of their business
model.
It seems to me that they actually have algorithms to identify sheep that are easy and risk-free to shear, you know, because, you know, like, they wouldn't do this to, I don't know, Elon Musk or Donald Trump, somebody who can fight back and who's well-known.
Or a publishing company that could hire big lawyers.
Yes, exactly. Or somebody, you know, whose profile is high enough that this would suddenly be known to millions of people. And so since
we're going to help it get out, Alex, and you're not as low profile, you're pretty high profile. We're going to help it get out. They're a disgusting organization. And as a result, actually, you've made some of these materials available for free. Please tell me, while we're dealing with this, how people can find them.
Yes. Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. So because Amazon, after they canceled me, they continued selling my titles, except now they put them at 900 euros a copy, or dollars, whatever it was. I saw that, you know, like, the people would assume that I was setting that price. So I put up the books free of charge on my website. So if anybody's interesting, they can find both titles on iSystem Trend Following, which iSystem-tf.com. And then under About tab, they will find the PDFs for both of those titles. So anybody who's interesting is welcome to download them. They're good quality materials. They're not just, you know.
Excellent. Or make a donation to amazon.com, shysterism.com, which is a terrible idea, of course. So you sense the sarcasm.
Yes.
There is only one option for how you should be accessing these books. Alex just gave it to us. Excellent. Well, Alex, it's been a crazy season. Let's get into the interview, the meaty part of it. Interest rates are one of the things where we are a little bit out there. Essentially, from the March 2020 events, we said that's it for bonds. Interest rates are going to continue to go broadly up. Of course, there'll be pullbacks all along the way, as is typical with markets. Some people started, Goldman Sachs analyst, surnamed Brooks, was saying again that inflation is clearly transitory and it's pulled back. Where do you stand on the great interest rates and the debt market? Is it going to go up in value, or are those yields continuing higher and going down?
Well, Francis, I'm a trend follower. The trend is down. And so as far as I'm concerned, you know, a trend, once it's well profiled, is more likely to continue than to reverse. And I think that, you know, last year, this trend has bottomed out temporarily. What is really concerning to me is that it hasn't been able to stage any kind of a meaningful reversal. So it's merely, you know, like the United States and European bonds, they've merely passed, I think, what was it, 9-10 months, just consolidating, going flat. And now they're back at the bottom end of the range, which to me is starting to look like a breakout to the wrong side, you know. So meaning down, higher interest rate and lower bond prices. And I think that the, you know, the macro picture, as far as I understand it, is actually makes it more likely that that's the outcome we're going to see.
And what surprises me is how few mainstream financial editorials are actually preparing people for the potential of an interest rate spike, which, as I paraphrased it, would be the controlled demolition of your personal finances, given it's that time of a year, 22 years ago. Shouldn't everybody be getting out of leverage? Shouldn't all the money columns in the Financial Times and all the other newspapers be actually warning people about exposure to debt and rate hikes, even spikes?
Well, I think that the money columns in these, you know, FT and Wall Street Journal and, you know, your CNBCs and Bloomberg TVs and all of these people, they've never been very good at providing good advice to investors. In fact, they've always been awful. And that's, you know, like it's masked a little bit by the fact that over the last 15 years, we had the longest and biggest bull market in the history of history, you know. And in that environment, anywhere you threw your money, you made some. Any commentary that's bullish was bound to be broadly right on the money. And so, you know, they built this illusion of expertise. But anytime a risk event occurs in the market, everybody gets caught flat-footed. And I think that now we are at the time of almost maximum risk, because interest rates appear bound to go higher. Bond prices seem that they will continue in a bear market. And really, the stock market prices are very near to all-time historical highs. So, you know, the situation is rife with risk. And I don't know what all these experts are looking at, but maybe they think, because, you know, we have the inverted yield curve, that inflation is going to go down and interest rates are going to go down. So it's going to be, everybody's going to live happily ever after indefinitely, and just, like, you know, buy the dip and go long and stay long and think no further than that. I believe that it's going to be wrong and extremely painful for people.
I find it hard to find much to disagree with in that. Debt markets down, interest rate yields up. And of course, the namesake of mastering the commodities, as in your book title, how about what's the corollary for that? Surely it's a commodity bull market that comes out of this in terms of energies, precious metals, agris, and many other things. Any favorites and any core areas that you're most excited about in terms of upside for that as interest rates spike and cost of living continues to climb?
Well, generally, no, Francis, because I deliberately embrace agnosticism with regards to individual markets. You know, I'm a trend follower. I use algorithmic trading. You know, my system tells me go long this, go short that. Having said that, you know, I've observed that over the last maybe not quite 10 years, but maybe starting in 2015, 2016, in many of the markets where we saw significant trends evolve, we saw these gradual trends that then suddenly explode into a practically vertical climb. You know, we saw that with cobalt, with platinum, with Bitcoin, with with many stocks. And I don't know how to explain this exactly, but what I suspect is because, you know, we have more than 200 trillion worth of investable liquid assets sloshing around in the shadow banking system, and all these markets are relatively small, that it takes very little, even a little bit of excitement about, you know, between these, you know, what's a shadow banking system? It's the pension fund, it's endowments, it's hedge funds and private equity. And, you know, like if even a little bit of excitement gets sparked over some asset, you know, 2 years ago it was Bitcoin, in 2016 it was Palladium, it was, you know, cobalt, one thing after another. We had many of those practically vertical climb that were not 20, 50%, 100%, but sometimes 500% rises. And I think that the one market that's been conspicuously absent in all this has been the precious metals. So gold and silver have done nothing. Platinum, it's almost like everybody hates it. But I think that, you know, at some point, the markets are going to embrace these assets. And I think that at that point, probably gold and silver have a lot of ways up to go. You know, if we remember last time we had an inflationary environment in the 1970, you know, if you go back to 1971, gold was trading at $35 per ounce. And over the next 10 years, it gradually rallied up to $850 per ounce. So, you know, that's what, 24 times? I don't know my math right now, but
yeah, 3 to 100 times 8, 24 times ish.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So it went up 20-fold, and I think that silver went up something like 50-fold. So even a fraction of that scenario, we could see gold and silver and much, much higher valuations. And I think it's not really unrealistic because, as you say, and I think you're completely right, we're moving into something that's been labeled as a commodity supercycle. And inflation, I think it's an illusion that inflation is gone. You know, I think even if you look at the history of inflation during the 1940s and during the 1970s, you see that in both cases we had three big waves. You know, like there was three waves of inflation accelerating, rising up, and then over the next 2-3 years declining, and then another wave and then another wave. And I think that in this current cycle, we've seen one leg up, and then a deceleration of inflation. But the cycle is only begun. And you know, normally these cycles last 10 to 15 years. We've only had now inflation on the radar since mid 2021. So what? It's been a year and a half.
Yes, nothing. Yeah. And it's really just getting started. Because we're getting the oil back up. I actually did a YouTube recently on a live cattle. I did some markets we don't always cover. Live cattle, beautiful rounded bottom, making new all-time highs. So that's your meat market. Coffee has been very high. Sugar is beautiful rounded basing bottom going up. And of course, oil is heading up. It's gone from the 80s into the 90s now. And that's such a big one. I mean, on its own, that's a game changer. And then, of course, we're starting to get even natural gas turning, which got really slammed after the mild European winter. Of course, we're going for Northern Hemisphere winter season again. So I think the first wave is not even the worst wave. And I think also in terms of, let's get to slightly conspiratorial, I suppose, if you look at where they want to go, They want everybody controlled and stripped of assets. And one of the best ways to do that is an interest rate spike that destroys the middle classes, people that are over leveraged, particularly in the Western world, which is probably their primary attack vector of bringing everybody down to the lowest common denominator. An interest rate spike actually will kill American housing. It'll flush out a lot of people at the lows. And good old BlackRock will have a jumble sale to attend and scooping things up on the cheap, only to rent them back to people. That's the playbook I see we've been taken down. What do you think of the role of something like BlackRock? In fact, James Corbett just recently released he always does great research, a good piece on BlackRock, how it's emerged. And just an interesting point on BlackRock, it came out of Lehman. A lot of the people came out of Lehman with the bust of Lehman. And of course, the main man was from CS First Boston after he lost $100 million, our friend Fink. And interesting, Lehman was actually initially a Zionist Ashkenazi slave plantation in the South that turned to banking many hundreds of years ago. So it's quite an interesting seed. So into Lehman, into BlackRock, and now we see it's suddenly become this behemoth on behind closed doors, and now it's suddenly emerged. Now they do the negotiation with Argentina for the government on debt restructuring. I mean, it's almost like we are the intermediary and the only people with the skills to do this, and even the state, the Fed, hires us to do stuff. Where do you stand on that particular mega oligopoly and your comments?
I think that BlackRock and Vanguard and these types of outfits are simply a modern repackaging of the very exact same problem that humanity has grappled with since, what is it, 8th century before Christ in Greece. And it's always the conflict between the oligarchies, the money-lending oligarchies, and everybody else, And it doesn't even matter if we're talking about Russian, Chinese, or Americans. It's, them against the whole rest of the humanity. And, it seems that they have, they have no reverse gear. It's practically criminally pathologic juggernaut that just almost unstoppably tries to vacuum up all the wealth in the world, control all the collateral, and gradually they take they start spilling over into the political sphere.
Yeah,
and it's always the same thing.
Well, that's what the fellow oil mark too, isn't it? Only on almost a bigger, more globalized scale. They'll be giving pennies to kids to win, PR, because he went through a terrible PR and perception. And there's recently been, why does everybody hate Larry Fink? type now.
Yeah, and Larry, yes, exactly. And Larry Fink has now become some sort of an executive director implementing exactly this same rapacious, acquisitive strategy of the oligarchy, which basically, I think it pretty much seeks to turn themselves into the permanent superior caste and turns everybody else into slaves and serfs that own nothing and are supposed to be happy that way. I don't know if it's going to work out that way, because I think that for the first time in human history, perhaps this is clear to a significant segment of the human population. Maybe we're not talking about my majority in any sense, but maybe 100 years ago this was apparent to some people very close up to the banking system or the merchant system, people like Ezra Pound or Lord Acton, who understood how the system worked, but most of the population had no idea. I think that today there's certainly a percentage of people, whether it's 5% or 10% or 20%, who are beginning to understand these things and who are beginning to push back. And one thing that I have observed over the past, particularly past 3-4 years with the pandemic and with the war in Ukraine, is that actually people just simply not cooperating is extremely challenging for them. It's just that the whole system grinds to a halt unless people kind of actively participate and cooperate with it. So I think that the BlackRocks of this world and the Vanguards of this world are running into very significant headwinds. And okay, so I don't want to go into too much into the conspiratorial part of thing, but going back to the, you know, commodity super cycle and how the geopolitics might be affecting it. There's another factor that is quite a difference over the last several centuries, namely that this Western oligarchy has always had this explicit strategy of keeping the population immiserated, because they would prefer.
What do you mean by immiserated? Help some.
I mean, yeah, I mean, poor, too poor, both as individual people and as nations, too poor to develop their own industries and to absorb the resources that they themselves produce. And then to grow, you know, prosperous, and then put upward pressure on these, on you know, oil and metals and foodstuffs, so that the, you know, the Western corporations have no competition for acquisition of these resources, so that they're cheap. So this was, for a long time, putting pressure on the prices of commodities, especially in the last few decades. And I think that this is changing now because, you know, there's Russia and China. China has a very different strategy. China has positioned itself as a global manufacturing hub, and they want to export their production to other countries. So they want these countries to actually be prosperous so that they have billions of affluent people around the world who can buy their crap, right? And so I think that this is a completely new variable in the equation, which could put tremendous upward pressure on the prices of commodities. So when we're talking about this commodity super cycle, you know, I've seen financial analysts look at the last 150 years and you have these big, massive waves, but we haven't seen, you know, like this was all under Western hegemony. God knows what's going to happen as the Western hegemony erodes. And I think that the upward pressure on commodities is only going to be that much stronger. So we might be looking at price relationships that we've never seen.
Oh, I think there's a simplistic notion that you can say the Western hegemony was anti-commodity, pro-financialization of everything. So they were the leverages of everything, the usury and the interest rates. And actually, they didn't serve commodity nations. Brazil wasn't well served in it. Mexico wasn't well served in it. I don't think Southern Africa, where I am, anywhere in Africa was well served in it. And I think the BRICS is part of unleashing that. And I think that's part of why Russia is one of the most, particularly in the energies area, of course, but they're very strong in platinum and metals as well, is particularly looking forward. And you look at the share ratings on the Russian stock market, some very big silver producers, obviously some massive, absolutely massive energy producers. And you look at the share ratings of what you mentioned looks exceedingly steamy in America. And you've got to say the money's going to move east, or the global south, as they now say. I'm a bit confused by that one. But anyway, it's going to move away. And there's going to be a sustained, it may not all happen in one crash, but decades of stagnation, especially with boomers being timed out with their flu remedies. There's going to be a lot of money coming out of equities. And I can see, wow, you know, I can see a lot of that being repurposed. And finding its way to the east. And of course, gold is the big thing. And Kissinger, 100 years old, managed to get on a plane to travel to China. He doesn't do much travel nowadays. What did you make of that?
I thought that was extremely interesting. I mean, you know, China has been at the receiving end of so much diplomacy, and much of it is very bizarre. Remember, first Antony Blinken then went there, and of course he behaved like an elephant in a China shop. And then right after him went Janet Yellen. And this was really weird because she spent 4 days in Beijing. She didn't see Xi Jinping, but she saw a lot of other Chinese officials. But it wasn't clear why she was there. The purpose of her visit wasn't properly explained. Chinese readouts were very, you know, like almost nothing. The only thing that we saw is that for a very short period of time, the Chinese sell-off of U.S. Treasury reversed. Remember? So it was looking like that. Then there was like a little kink up, but then it resumed. It just went down back again. And
Didn't Nancy Pelosi make some funny remarks while Yellen was over? I remember there was that very bizarre, are we visiting, what's going on with Taiwan, a little bit of a hula hoo. Everyone was thinking there was something brewing, and then it just petered out, and we never really got a full answer on that. But it was quite bizarre, as you say. And then having the big guy, you know, the ultimate chieftain behind the ESG and BlackRock. I mean, I'm pretty confident if you follow BlackRock, Vanguard, you end up up to the City of London Corporation and the big old families that are from all over Europe. Many people now named, and that America was never born free. They were sold a great story with Levi jeans and cowboys, but it was never born free. It was born in masonry, and that's where we end up. And now it's reached its purpose. And unfortunately, it feels like the fattened cow is now weighted under parasites and is ready to be abandoned by the parasites for pastures anew. And that's why it's an incredibly fascinating time to be alive, because there's a transition that we're going to see, isn't there? What do you think is the most important takeouts for you in terms of the great transition that is coming our way? And how should people play it as well, in your view?
Okay, so I'll just go back to Henry Kissinger for a second, because I'm going to speculate a little bit, because it seems to me, you know, if you look at the American administration, you have the neocons who are keep beating the war drums. And so they're sending a signal, we want to go to war with China. And then you get the treasury officials, you know, people from the banking system who are going there and saying like, no, please just keep buying our treasury. Don't tell them.
I'm the
exactly. So the messaging is very schizophrenic, and I think that Henry Kissinger probably went there to reassure the Chinese that they have no intention of going to war against China, which I'm convinced that they don't, because you can see it in the conduct of the American military establishment. If they were serious about going to war against a power like China, they would be preparing for that war. They wouldn't be buying red stilettos for their generals and hiring drag queens as their spokespeople for the Navy. You know, they wouldn't be actively, constantly destroying the morale of the institution that is meant to fight this war. So obviously they have no intention. I think...
But if they're setting it up for a war it's designed to lose... And that as a possibility. In other words,
I think deeply a war... Yeah, and I think it would be a war designed to continue for no other reason, because it creates domestically, it creates the kind of emergency that then justifies anything.
Markable lockdowns.
And we're even going to the point in history where the war doesn't even have to be real. You know, like Orwell wrote, there were these constant wars, but nobody even knew whether these wars were really happening or not. It was just in the news. You know, this happened, that happened, you know, the war is on, we've always been at war against East Asia or Eurasia, whatever it be, and it's only serving the purpose of keeping domestically people under psychosis, under an emergency
mentality.
Siege mentality, and then the government in power can do anything, you know, like if you... Exactly.
Very good for money laundering and child trafficking and other forms of backward forwards, which is dark.
Precisely.
So you don't need to know what's going on there. Don't you know there's a war on? You know, something's secret. You know, we're trying to keep you safe.
Exactly. So, you know, like if you can't get your medicines, if your pension is not being paid out, if they locked you out of your money, they can always say like, oh, it's the Chinese, it's the war. You know, we're all in this together. We have to keep together, blah, blah, blah. And I bet you that what Henry Kissinger went to tell the Chinese is it's business as usual. We just need to keep the people at home a little bit on their toes, and that's why there's this rhetoric of war against China. We don't really mean it. We have no intention of going to war against you. And so your next question was how to prepare for all this. Well, you know, I have to say I gave this a lot of thought back when I was extremely pessimistic about where all this was going, you know. And I think that I was pessimistic up until about 2015. And my pessimism started to reverse in 2015 for two reasons. Well, the main reason was Russian intervention in Syria. And Russian intervention in Syria, to me, was a very real indication that Vladimir Putin is not controlled opposition, that he actually is fighting in his own camp, and that he is defending Russia's sovereignty, and that Russia became today a very worthy adversary and a real challenger to the Western hegemony. So, but, you know, back when I was extremely pessimistic, I kind of thought that the, you know, obviously you have to have some gold and silver bullion. I remain agnostic about the cryptocurrencies. You know, I think that as a technology, they're awesome. They're extremely valuable and useful, but I'm not sure that their current incarnations, or, you know, the current forms of currencies are actually useful. You know, like I would be a lot more convinced if I could go to a cafe today and get, you know, a coffee and an orange juice and pay it in Bitcoin. Then I would be a lot more bullish on it. But until that's a reality, there's a lot of risks. There's a lot of risk, and you know, the ruling establishment still has a lot of ways of harassing people and preventing them from using the currency, or even benefiting from you know, capital gains on those currencies. I think that another, you know, maybe the most important way to prepare would be, if you can, whoever can, to try to migrate towards relatively smaller communities that have a continuity of at least 300 years as settlements, you know, so that, you know, which should indicate
become
that they
Amish.
Have... Sorry?
Become Amish.
Well, you know, it's valid, because, you know, like, I think that if a community has continued existence in some location for more than 300 years, that indicates that they're economically viable even before the Industrial Revolution. And then, you know, make yourself useful to that community, and then, you know, you can exchange whatever skills you have with the people who live in that community. You know, there's going to be a dentist and a car mechanic and a baker, and, you know, some people are going to have chickens and eggs and milk cows. And then, you know, you can weather any crisis. I think that we shouldn't be too afraid of what's coming at us, because, you know, if you look at what the world looked like in 1918, you know, 105 years ago, what we're experiencing today is walk in the park so far, you know, so far. And so it shouldn't be too difficult to weather through. And as we know, all these horrible crisis situations like First World War, Second World War, the Great Depression, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Cuban crisis. I'm not talking about Cuban Missile Crisis, but Cuban economic crisis when the Soviet Union collapsed. You know, people come through. You just need a little bit of resilience in your setup. You know, you need to cut down your overhead. You need to reduce your spending. You need to have some gold and silver bullion, preferably some land that you can use for agriculture, and you need to cultivate
proper lines,
connections with your local community. And actually, you know, when you look at the way our authorities react to local organization, then you know that this is the right way to go, because they've been hysterical to prevent any kind of local, conferences, get-togethers, fairs, yes, and so on. I was invited to Ireland to speak at a conference called Think Local. The first time around, they managed to organize it because they organized it in a secret venue. So they advertised one venue, only in order for people to tell people to go to the right venue, right? Because somebody from the government was going around discovering where this was going to be held and then putting pressure on these venues to cancel. So that was in February. They managed to pull it off. In July, they were going to do the same thing, but this time the government managed to cancel absolutely all the venues, and the conference had to be canceled. And you know, this is just like ordinary people getting together, talking about their problems and discussing solutions, inviting some speakers to share their know-how and experience. This is all, you know, these are not terrorists, these are not criminals, these are not undocumented migrants, nothing. Patriotic, law-abiding Irish.
It's an illegal gathering. I think it's an illegal gathering. We should stamp this out.
On the other hand, it's also telling you where it's at, you know, because if it's that important for the authorities to prevent these things from happening, then that tells you that this is exactly what we should be doing.
The apartheid government used to to suppress the local organization of the then African community, used to say any number more than, and they would provide a number of 9 people assembled in one place, then constituted an illegal gathering, you know. So you'd have, and then they'd have certain distances. So people would form 9 people and then have a certain distance, there'd be another 9. I mean, it's absurd once you start getting into this. The freedom of association and the freedom to organize has to be a fundamental freedom along with freedom of speech. And the fact that government is obstructive tells you who the enemy is. People don't understand. This is one of the key messages. You are in a war. You just haven't realized it. It's a mental war. It's a psyop war. It's a financial war. It's a suppression of rights war. It's a freedom of movement war. It's a freedom of everything. All your freedoms are under attack. You're under surveillance. You're under 15-minute city, slow. The riot police have an operation they refer to as kettling, where they actually seal off certain roads, get everybody in the roundabout, and then lock it off, and then slowly just tighten, and then make everybody sit down, and then wait it out until everyone's calmed down. Then they don't even let people get out to pee. They literally have to pee where they stand. And that's a riot police strategy. And what we're actually witnessing is the kettling of the global village of society into no freedom of movement, minimal sit down, don't do anything. We're watching you, totally observed, enforcement all around you. It is the kettling of society, isn't it? And you've got to get local, as you say. You've got to get organized, and you've got to become self-reliant as well. State as final provider of things like utilities. Everybody needs to be off-grid, surely. You want your own power, you want your own water, and you want to clean it. You want to make sure that nothing's been put in it. And you don't want to use the smart grid, even though there might be inducements and conveniences to go with that. It's where we're at. And how else do we fight the state and push back? Because it is statism. Interesting that currently BlackRock isn't officially a World Economic Forum group, but we know that they are essentially an attack axis of World Economic Forum. But when do you think, and how, when do we see that obvious tie between Fink, apart from them being the primary ESG enforcers, and of course the World Economic Forum being climate, the climate is the killer, we will need, you know, that, apart from the obvious similarities on certain agenda points, they've tried to keep a little bit of an arm's length, but this is all a fake distance, isn't it? You know, they'll even ask Fink about the World Economic Forum, and you know, you'll pretend like he doesn't meet these guys behind closed doors, but it's all an act. It's all a puppet show, surely. What's your take on that?
Well, yeah, obviously, you know, it's they have to put on a facade that looks acceptable.
Quasi-independent. You know,
yeah, exactly. And of course, they're never going to tell, well, I shouldn't say never, because they did tell us thing like you'll owe nothing and be happy, but you know, they have to pretend that they are, you know, concerned individuals who are, you know, looking out for us and trying to put out constructive solutions. Philanthropists, exactly.
My favorite word is philanthropist. I just want to give. I really, really, I just want to give back. Yeah, indeed you do. to your own foundation and its agendas. It's fascinating how much they've hid behind the narrative of philanthropy.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, Larry Fink obviously is part of that whole machine, and there's no chance on earth that they're not closely coordinating what they're doing. And it's also quite clear that they're, part of their objectives is a radical depopulation of the earth, you know, a creation of this airtight control grid where, you know, you can do anything without permission. But, you know, on the... You asked me what we can do to push back against this, and I think that simple non-compliance goes a long way to seed this system with 100 million acts of friction, which I think will inevitably bring it down. I think it's you know, there. I looked a little bit into these you know, Agenda 2030 and what the World Economic Forum has published on their website. They purged some of their documents because I think they've lost their self-confidence to a large extent. But the agenda is so megalomaniacally ambitious. And these people who are writing up these documents don't have any idea what they're talking about. You know, like, they have these conceptual visions of something, but they have no idea how to make it happen. They think that by giving money to clever technocrats, engineers, scientists, that these people will just build it for them magically. They don't understand that there's a complexity to the system that goes way beyond what they can control and what they can implement. And you know, if we just don't comply, the thing falls down like a house of cards. And I don't want to tell the very long story, but a last article I published on my Substack is titled "The Power of Noncompliance," and it's about something that I observed during the 2020 new normal. And it was actually much later that I realized what I was looking at. And what I was looking at is a very carefully planned dystopia new normal completely unravel within the space of 4 days, because it was contrary to human nature, meaning people didn't comply, not for any reason. They just didn't think it was, you know, they just thought it was, the whole thing was very stupid. And even the police probably felt stupid about enforcing it. It was obvious that they felt stupid about enforcing it. And so, you know, what a handful of ideologues and technocrats at the top can think up is very questionable, whether the whole, you know, command and control structure can implement and enforce, and whether they want to either. So I think all we have to do is, you know, organize at the local level, build in a little bit of resilience into our lives and activities, you know, cultivate skills that are useful to people around you. Cultivate bonds with people in your local community. Learn who knows how to do things you need, you know, fix your roof, fix your car, you know, fix your electricity, grow food, who has eggs, who has, you know. And whatever crisis is coming our way, we're going to weather it. Some people are not going to come through, but, you know, that's how it is, you know, that whether the predator is a virus or a, you know, oligarch class, they do draw some casualties in these big clashes, but I think that most of us are going to come through. And I would wager that with the lessons that we've learned in the last few years, we should be able to do something better than what we've known in the past.
Yes, I agree. It was interesting. I was quoting a gent I like to talk with quite a bit. And one of the things he said was, population and reproductive control is a key function of parasites in nature. So in a natural environment, when you're not talking in the human sector, it's the parasitic element that actually reduces quality of life and reduces health, reduces product birth rates, birth numbers. Unhealthy animals don't breed; they don't one of your ability to reproduce is one of the first thing that goes. If you're underfed, if you're under everything, it's deemed a non-essential for survival, if you understand. And it's really interesting, that observation that he made, because you now have a name for those that are the great intermediaries of these agendas. And I do think you have to also view the popular hate figures of Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab as exactly that, you know, the sheeple hate puppet, and the anonymous City of London shareholders are the ones that are the real beneficiaries from these people. They would never put themselves in the line. These are almost the tethered goats. They get paid very well. They're very rich tethered goats. But they are put out there, and the real violently rich that seek ultimate power of both your life and death in their hands are not the ones that are, you know, doing their TED talks about how awesome it will be to reduce population and et cetera. But we tend to get all encompassed with the Punch and Judy show and go, Bad policeman, don't hit that lovely Judy with the truncheon. Meanwhile, you know, it's the hands in the puppets. You should be pulling the curtain, walking around the back of the stall and pulling the curtain to see the backside of the real master puppeteers. And they're no names. They're rarely named.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree entirely with what you said. But I think that something is changing on that front as well. The second book I published was called Grand Deception. It's about Bill Browder, the Magnitsky Act, and the anti-Russian sanctions. I suspect that most of these subjects are not household terms and not familiar, but what it is we're talking about the Magnitsky legislation that was enacted in 2012 in the United States, lobbied through by one Bill Browder, who is either a CIA asset or an MI6 assets. He's definitely very close to the City of London. His partner in crime is HSBC. And the
opium drug, the bank established on opium,
yes,
sales.
That one.
It sent British soldiers to die to enforce the right to keep selling.
Exactly.
And the Chinese people wanted to not have their daughters turned into prostitutes and their sons turned into hopeless wrecks. Yeah, just thought I'd remind
everybody
of
HSBC. Yes, that fine institution. And so, the Magnitsky Act, when it was passed in the U.S. Congress in 2012, it was deemed the opening salvo of the new Cold War. And the Magnitsky Act is actually a legal abomination in the perspective of Western legal institution, because what it entails is that some unnamed nobody from the United States Department of the Treasury can put anybody on a list of sanctions with no recourse, no due process, and that person can be barred from entering the United States. They can have their assets frozen, confiscated, and so forth. This was all sold as human rights legislation, you know, where the United States was fighting against people who, you know, who were guilty of human rights abuses in countries like Russia and other countries. It was afterwards extended. What it actually was a way to blow up, the way to block access to Western jurisdictions, to people from Russia or other countries. And why? Because during the 1990s, when Russia was transitioning from quote-unquote communism to quote-unquote capitalism, Russia was overrun by Western financiers, advisors, experts, and they literally stole trillions of dollars worth of Russian assets, and all of these assets were disappeared through
oligarchs.
Through offshore centers, through, you know, Cyprus and Switzerland and British Virgin Islands and Cayman Islands and so forth, and then, you know, it disappeared into the pockets of people hiding behind these offshore
you know, companies.
Abramovich, Berezovsky, Kodorsky, all of the Zio inclination.
Yeah, but these guys were also the tethered goats, you know, the exposed trustees of the actual beneficial owners. So, you know, during this process, I think that Russian authorities put together very detailed, hundreds of detailed investigation files that are ready, that were ready to be taken to, you know, London and Zurich and Geneva, to Cyprus, to, you know, initiate legal proceedings, to start the discovery process, and to trace these assets to their ultimate beneficial owners. And then, you know, like, they panicked, they enacted this Magnitsky legislation, and now they can block any person, any organization that wants to investigate this. You know, it's like how do you call it, the moat around their citadel, where all the treasures are hidden. But here's the problem. The Russians are extremely persistent, and they will not give up. You know, these files are not going to disappear. They're not going to recognize any kind of the clause when after 20 years the thing goes obsolete.
Expiry or sunsets clause, yeah.
Yeah, there's a legal term that now escapes me. But you know what I mean. Anyway.
Yeah.
They're not going to recognize that. They're going to be pursuing this. And so, you know, the fight in Ukraine, if Russia prevails, I think that one of the things that they're going to push for is the overturn of these Magnitsky legislations. And then they are going to be bringing on suits in London and New York and BVI and where have you. And there, I think, it's what it seems to me from observing the strategy and the conduct and the statements of the leadership from Russia and from China is that they're actually going after these oligarchies, and that their ultimate goal is to root them out and to disenfranchise them completely. So I think that there's a good chance that in the, you know, through this decade or two of crisis that we're going to experience, there's going to be a lot of pressure on these oligarchies. They're going to panic. It's going to get extremely interesting. But I think that there's a chance that they're looking at you know, sunset of their run of the Western world.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Well, I mean, that came under your heading, which I was going to actually ask you about, because I was looking at your Substack, The Cause for Optimism, because if I'm honest, I'm sometimes accused of being overly dark about these things. Nonetheless, I think we still have to play our part and push back regardless. And I do think, unfortunately, when you've weaponized the media, you've weaponized the pharmaceutical complex, you've weaponized the military industrial complex, and now even the pharmaceutical complex are buying up all the supplement companies, so you can't get really clean family supplements. They'll quickly start contaminating everything. I tend to feel that so many resources concentrated in such organized hands that organization and a plan beats genius, even if we were to be genius. But nonetheless, it's good that there's these subplots of East versus West, where the one does undo certain aspects of the other. And I also don't think the Russian, if we just refer to the injectable cure, was particularly toxic either. And they actually made claims that they reached out to the Western corporations about the nature of theirs, because they'd done something similar but hadn't done X, Y, and Z, and said, you know, this is not going to work and it's going to actually be particularly toxic and or dangerous, and we had a door shut in their face. So there's some interesting sub-narratives, because of course Putin is very pro-family and population. He is currently paying women to have children. So there is actually, we're all getting the population agenda and how disgusting it is to have a three-person, three-kid family now in the Western world. But in actual fact, you're getting exactly the opposite in Russia. And the manner in which he went about his version was not in the same way. And I don't think you've had the same blowback in terms of after effects that certain genomes, gene types, and certain versions of the has caused here in the West. So there's a game to be played, and I really want to bring that value to our community that will be watching this. And I say it regularly, you need to leave the traditional white European nation states, because the game and the rule that is being perpetuated there, whilst on the surface it looks pretty standard and globally synchronized, there's actually quite a lot of cracks and arbitrage that can be had. And certainly within each nation states, there's definitely different agenda types. If you were to get the mandatory injectable cure, it would have been better to have it done in Crimea, Russia, than it would have been maybe in other parts of the world, the Midwest of America, for example. And I think that single template is actually a model. And it's a difficult one to say to people, but hey, if you're in the UK, Deagle stats don't look good for you. Leave, you know, because they have families, they have jobs, they have everything. Go somewhere else. But I do think it's time to be rather in a BRICS nation, and there's plenty of English language speaking that goes on in BRICS nations, than it is to be in the Northern American, old Commonwealth, Anglo-Saxon realm. How do you approach this topic? Because location is, you know, a large part of where funny stuff tends to happen.
Yes. Well, you know, I'm actually kind of glad that I'm not in the UK. And, you know, if I were in the US, I would probably try to be closer to Florida or Texas and try to avoid the places like California, Washington State, or New York. So, you know, where you are probably matters. I live in Monaco, and I'm actually quite glad that I am, because, you know, Monaco is part of, you know, the EU, but it does tend to treat its residents in a more soft glove kind of way. You know, even during the lockdowns, they were not very, very strict. They enforced the rules, but, you know, they didn't send riot police to chase people around and beat them. And so, you know, it was okay. And I see that the public administration of the government is still staffed by ordinary people who have ordinary concerns and understand other ordinary people. So, you know, even if the rule says XYZ, you go there, you talk to the person, and they say like, don't worry about it. You know, that can mean a lot in a given moment in time. And then I'm from Croatia, and also I remember that during the lockdowns in Croatia, the enforcement was particularly lax. You know, not because nobody took the situation seriously, quite to the contrary, but because, you know, just law enforcement is lax, period. You know, so that, you know, you only have so much police. And people tend to be, you know, people in Croatia are not exactly like, you know, those people you saw in Walmart reacting hysterically to somebody not wearing a mask. Yeah. So, for example, my mother never wore a mask. She would go to the supermarket. Somebody would tell her, "Miss, can you please put a mask on?" And she would say, "Sorry, I don't have one." And they would go like, "All right." And that's that. So, you know, location is important, because in some places it's a bit more loose and mellow. I would think maybe southern states like Italy, Croatia, Spain, France, whereas farther up north, as we saw in Austria and Germany and parts of UK, it was pretty draconian during the worst part of it. So if you can,
Strong on stuff in Italy as well, and Spain, but it was more isolated. The Singapore and the Asians are very, very compliant. I'm a fan of the Eastern Europe. Croatia is a beautiful country, by the way. One of my most favorite places to visit. Amazing sea. Swimming in the sea and getting vitamin D are one of the best things you can do under that particular guise.
Exactly.
And I've seen this Bolshevik communism before. I find the Eastern Europeans are probably a little wiser in terms of the hustle of this agenda than many Westernized Europeans or North Americans would be. It's just like they've lived it.
Yes, you know, many of us remember communism, you know, so we saw the communist system, we saw the next system that came, and we also lived through the wars of succession in the 1990s. So I think that people here are quite used to the idea that the media are lying to them. So I think that the percentage of people who go with the official narrative and don't question it is lower than what you find in the West. That's, you know, like in Western nations, there's this propaganda, there's this conviction that this is the peak of human civilization, that we have it the best ever, that everything works at some kind of an optimum, and therefore people haven't really questioned the premises. They haven't questioned how their government and how their authorities function, who they're accountable and liable to. Do they have people's best interest in mind? They just simply believe in this auto-magical self-perfecting system where all you have to do is go along passively and acquiesce to whatever is coming your way, because in some way it's probably going to work out for the best and everything's going to be a lot better than it was before. But, you know, today we see that even this has changed, because, you know, for the first time in, I think, several generations, people in the West even start to report that they actually think that their children's lives are not going to be as good as their own life. So, you know, they're realizing that it isn't really a magical self-perfecting system.
Absolutely. And long may that waking up process go, and long may the non-compliance that we hope for go. Eventually, though, it turns to force, surely, because it is totalitarianism they want. It is a global communism they want. And therefore, they start kettling you in, making it law. And any breach or non-compliance is then deemed a criminalized legal event, which can see further forfeiture, penitentiary, prisons, camps, etc. Are they not preparing for an escalation of this war on citizenry as part of their global population reduction, particularly against the non-compliant, which tends to be white European critical thinking nations?
Yeah, and for sure they are preparing for that, but it's not going to work. And the reason why I'm certain that it's not going to work is because, you know, first of all, if force was a good way to enforce their, plans, they would have resorted to it before. It's not that they are, you know, how do you call it, have some kind of a sentimental attachment to our...
I don't think they had that same level of control before and legalized backup. I think, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we look at the Patriot Act, which is anything about patriotism, the Inflation Act reduction, which is anything about reducing inflation. Everything they bring in is a misnomer, inversion, perversion label. And they actually want to be able to be perceived to have moved legally, so much so that they write the laws, the law is an ass. So you see the Californication, which is this $951 mark, is the only, you know, a number of items that you can steal value worth $950 is the value, and without even being seized. So how's retail shoppers, and they can go do that in every store. So this whole legalization of theft and making people aware of this is designed to crash the system. It is overt, and the law is an absolute ass because it's being determined by people that intend to destroy these states. None of us in our sane minds could say there's anything that's beneficial for people to be able to go around and steal $950 worth of stock from a multitude of separate stores. That could be thousands in a day. And every day. So this is destructionism. It's destructionism by intent. It's not, people often put down, oh, it's incompetence, it's incompetence. It's not incompetence. Come on. This is practical, active destruction and legalization of theft, which will lead to the business closures, the breakdown. It's to destroy small businesses. And the big ones will have plenty of insurance that they'll pass on to the financial system, which will just push the taxes up and the premiums up on your car insurance, my motorcycle insurance, my house insurance. etc., etc. So it's part of it feeding the inflation frenzy to create a theft merry-go-round. And that is part of the hollowing out of the middle, and it is the interest rate super spike, and I can't see it as anything else. And when you have so much power, and you are now writing actively laws that almost anyone with, you know, 90 IQ can see as a society destruction-based regulation that the lowest common denominator will exploit and inflict, and almost with glee, you are creating all the wrong incentives, and it is the beginning of the end. And it's difficult to be optimism your way out of that. I want to be an optimist, but I'm just saying it's designed to fail, surely.
Well, you know, we see where we're at. We see that this wave is coming and that it's going to crash over us. So it's normal to feel the trepidation and, you know, like there's this, you know, dread of anticipation of what's coming our way. But, you know, we've lived through all this. I mean, we haven't, but, you know, other generations have. If you look at what happened in Russia 100 years ago when there was a Bolshevik coup and the it didn't kind of out of the clear blue skies. It's been brewing, and Russia has been subjected to escalating chaos in a similar way. You know, they were called nihilists, you know, young intelligentsia who wanted to do away with law, with everything. And they managed to take down a 1,000-year institution of Tsarism, and they created the Bolshevik Revolution. But, you know, even with the most heavy-handed draconian repression, that system was able to sustain itself for 70 years. And the reason why it was even able to be successful, you know, for revolutions, you need three very essential ingredients. A, you need a compelling ideology. And we don't have that. You know, today, what's the ideology? It's LGBT. LGBT is practically the only thing that they're going with. Everything else is fear-mongering, you know, climate alarmism, viruses, pandemics, and so on. The second extremely important ingredient are charismatic leaders. We don't have any charismatic leaders, you know. Exactly.
Although Biden is pretty inspiring. I watched an odd speech by Biden and I feel really motivated.
Well, I basically tend to feel a lot more moved when Ursula von der Leyen speaks, but I have to say Biden's not bad either.
Yes. And Agent Orange, as I call Christine Lagarde. Yeah, right. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, they are wooden, plastic, and half dead between them.
Yes, so we don't have an ideology, we don't have charismatic leaders, and then there needs to be an armed enforcement. There needs to be some kind of a military enforcement of that, you know, because a revolution causes a counter reaction. You know, there's always forces opposed, and then the thing can dissipate into a civil war, and the revolution cannot really succeed. So, you know, when the Bolsheviks took over the Soviet Union, there was a large, people don't know this because it's not taught in you know, history curriculum, but there was a large intervention by U.S., British, and European forces and the Japanese forces as well, that went there ostensibly to help the whites, you know, but in actuality, they went there to help Bolsheviks consolidate power because all they had was the administration of St. Petersburg and Moscow, but they needed Trans-Siberia.
And so they actually sent
the element
peacekeeping forces along the Trans-Siberian line all the way to Vladivostok to stop new revolutionaries coming and helping and supporting the White Russians.
Yes.
I mean,
exactly.
You see, those same forces, Alex, are around today and are more organized, better surveillance, better tools, more money, and a greater ability to fund and fool and finance.
I'm not sure about their ability. You know, we'll know. You know, and money. You know, you can. You know, like money is a funny thing. It depends what you do with it and what you spend it on. And if you don't have good things to spend it on, money is not very useful. You know, the West. As an example, has outspent Russia in defense spending by a factor of 10 or more So, you know, what we saw in the Bolshevik Revolution is that, you know, it was carried out at the time 100 years ago when there was a lot of, you know, the world was in turmoil. There was a lot of change. People were ill prepared for it. And then, you know, you threw in the communists with a very compelling ideology and some well-selected charismatic leaders like Lenin and Trotsky. And, you know, with a lot of money and with military enforcement and troops sent from abroad, from outside of Russia. And then that revolution, let's call it, succeeded, but it could not sustain itself but for 70 years, in spite of extremely, extremely heavy-handed and repressive policy to try to keep it together. And then, you know, we had similar regimes in a communist Albania, Romania, and East Germany. These were very, very...
I remember all that. But don't you think the whole thing of creating communism was to highlight and create the big surge of the capitalist era? That was part of the plan, to have the thesis and the antithesis. And now we are getting to the final global synthesis, which is actually the end of the master plan, and that's a global communism. Then if we're all in the global communism, there's no other country to be the counterforce. We are just there. And they knew they had to go escalations in steps. And they had to pivot from the one side to the other side. Anti-communism, pro-capitalism. And then, oh, capitalism bad, now we're going BRICS. Which is, and it's part of this cycle of we're actually climbing a turret and we're reaching the apex. Anyway... Maybe you're welcome to comment further on that, but I want to just get you in on the commodity markets as well, because you are master of the commodity markets after all. What is your best and favorite pick? And then refer back also to the communism discussion if you like, but your favorite pick, and how should people be building wealth? Because it's one thing to move country, get independent, self-reliant. You've got to try preserve your balance sheet and your finances. We've touched on precious metals and that they've yet to run. But of those that are already moving, what's catching your eye?
Okay, so back to the communist thing. I do agree with you, because this does seem to dovetail with their plans, with their agenda. But you know, what you put on paper as your plan, as an agenda, doesn't necessarily work out in reality. And I think that this time around, there's a new variable in the whole social political mix, which is the internet, you know, because we never had the internet. The internet is enabling us to communicate in ways that we've never been able to communicate before, and it gives us access to knowledge in ways that have never been possible before. So, you know, like even if you were just looking at this whole thing as an equation, as a mathematician, there is a new variable that makes all the previous projections, I wouldn't say irrelevant, but you know, whatever our historical parallels don't necessarily apply. So we cannot know what the outcome is going to be. But what is extremely different today than it ever was is that more and more people have awakened. A very large segment of the population has awakened. They understand what they do want, what they don't want, what the people in power have planned for them. And they are pushing back. They are pushing back through non-compliance. And so, hey, yeah, remains to be seen. But I tend to be cautiously optimistic, particularly based on what we have experienced in the last 3 years and how this massive assault on humanity that was the pandemic, which was very meticulously planned and very carefully implemented. Obviously, they were very determined that the old normal should never come back. Well, it did kind of, and the whole agenda dissipated and went away. So I think that most of their plans are going to end up that way. All right, so now back to commodities. I also hope I'm right, but you know, we're going to find out. We can't. Nobody has a crystal ball. I agree with what you said, and I think it's extremely important that, you know, people have to actively plan how to navigate through all this. And part of the plan has to include preserving your purchasing power, to not allow yourself to be put in the situation where you own nothing, because you're not going to be happy. You know, as Alexander Hamilton said, that the power over people's material wealth amounts to the power over their will. You know, so it's clear why they want us to own nothing, because they want us to be dependent on them and on the state. But, you know, we shouldn't allow them to achieve that. So we have to defend our savings, our investments, our purchasing power. And I believe that because probably the main method of dispossession is going to be inflation, where they're going to render worthless all your saving, especially for people who live on fixed income, like pensioners. I'm not going to state my opinion, but it's an empirical fact that far and away the best hedge against inflation is exposure to commodity futures. And I think that it stands to reason, because as the purchasing power of the currency declines, so the prices of the real assets, real things like energy and metals and gold and silver and food, agricultural commodities are going to be rising in prices. And so this is consistent with also the commodity super cycle hypothesis. And I believe that everybody who can should consider acquiring exposure to prices of commodities. Obviously, it's not practical for anybody to store barrels of oil in their garage and, you know, bushels of grain, but you can gain exposure to their prices either through futures, through CFDs, or through ETFs as well. You know, you have ETFs for agricultural commodities, for energy, for copper, gold, silver, and so forth. And so you should consider having that exposure if you can. Now, obviously, there's a level of difficulty in doing that, because most people do not know how to trade copper or cocoa or coffee or things like that. But I strongly recommend trying to learn how to do technical analysis. And I know that you, Francis, do a great job teaching people how to do technical analysis. So that's very important. And also to basically learn how to do trend following. Trend following, I think, is the only way that you can trade markets that you don't know. You know, people know stocks and bonds. People know companies. You know, they know why they might like Apple versus, some utility company and so forth. But you don't know necessarily what you think about cotton, whether it's going to go up or down, whether you should be long or short, or corn or soybeans or crude oil or heating oil, whatever. And so I think that, you know, the very simple hypothesis of my approach to investing is, and again, I'm going to be stating very defendable facts, and that is that far and away the most powerful driver of investment performance are large-scale price events. And large-scale price events always unfold as trends. And so trend following is the only way that you can sustainably and successfully navigate these large-scale price events in a variety of different markets and over sustained periods of time. So not in one cycle, but in indefinitely many cycles. And so investors should strongly consider that, look into it, study up a little bit. And there are even ETFs that copy the performance of CTAs, and CTA stands for commodity trading advisors. So I think that there's even an ETF whose code is CTA. So those are all things to look into. Obviously, you want to hold at least several months worth of your expenses in gold and silver bullion that you can hold in your hand. You know, not somewhere in some bank. And you know, beyond that, it's you know, cut your overhead, scale down your expenses as much as possible, or at least make yourself flexible in that way, and cultivate bonds with your neighbors, with your friends, with the people in your community, and make sure you make yourself a useful member to that community with your own skills. And that's about that.
That's a great set of golden rules, and I like them all. And as you say, trends are your friend. We are continuation pattern traders. We trade with the flow. Don't swim upstream, swim with the flow. Don't make your life harder trying to catch the pullbacks or the minor moves in opposite direction. They're often shorter than you think. They can be engulfed violently suddenly. And a lot of sound principles in there. Alex, it's been a pleasure having you on, and you've given very generously of your time. How do people engage with you? Please shout out how, your Twitter, your X following, your website, and all of those important facts.
Yeah, so the easiest way to find me is on Twitter or X. My handle is @NakedHedgy, and I have a Substack called Alex Craner's Trend Compass, and then I have a professional website called iSystem Trend Following, which is where people can find my two business titles, which are available free of charge. So they're welcome to download them and
worth $900 a piece. And selling for
that's right. That's right. It's and the more times you download it, the more money is saved.
Exactly. Exactly. Fabulous, Alex Craner. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for coming.
Francis, likewise. Thank you very much for having me. Warm greetings to you and to all your listeners and viewers. Thank you.
Bye for now.